from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Mina Kim. How can we control the high and rising cost of rent in California? One method, rent control regulation, has not moved forward in this state for 30 years, until this week. The East Bay City of Richmond approved rent control after a long and tense city council meeting. The debate pitted tenants afraid of being priced out against property owners and landlords concerned about overly restrictive regulations. In this hour, we'll explore how rent control actually works and consider whether it really is a viable way of protecting affordable housing. Rent control in California, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. Good morning. I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News, sitting in for Mina Kim. Here's an uncomfortable question for many people living in the Bay Area today. How much do you expect to be paying in rent next year? These days, the rising cost of housing is making many people very thankful that their rents go up slowly under rent control laws. A handful of California cities have rent control, including Berkeley, East Palo Alto, San Francisco, and San Jose. And now, Richmond is on that list. Richmond City Council approved a rent control ordinance after a long and heated meeting this week. For many tenants, it is a godsend. Protection from market rate rents that could gentrify their neighborhoods and force them out. For many landlords and property owners, it is a blunt object, an overcorrection in response to a legitimate problem that will ultimately do more harm than good. Who's right? In this hour of Forum, we'll hear from both sides and take your questions and thoughts on how to protect the Bay Area's renters from being priced out. Joining us here in the studio is Christopher Palmer. He is an assistant professor at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business. Christopher, good morning.
Thank you. Long time listener, first time guest.
Well, we're glad to have you. And also here with us this morning is Dean Preston. He is the executive director of the statewide renters advocacy group Tenants Together. Dean, welcome to Forum.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Also joining us by phone from Sacramento is Tom Bannon. He is the CEO of the California Apartment Association, a trade group for the rental industry. Tom, welcome.
Thank you, Joshua.
Christopher Palmer, let me start with you. First, let's get some basic information just so we're all on the same page. We should define this term. What exactly is rent control? What do we mean when we're describing that?
So rent control is a law or an ordinance that is either restricting the level of rents or curtailing their growth.
And it's the kind of a measure that limits – do all rent controls limit year after year? Is that typically the way they work, or are there various kinds of rent control?
Various kinds across the country, across the world, various kinds.
Give us a few. Describe
a few. So in Cambridge, for example, they got rid of their rent control policy in 1995. Every year, the rent control board would get together. Every apartment in the city with some kind of overall – growth, there would be a red book in City Hall. You would go, you would look up your address, and it would say your maximum rent was $803, and that was your apartment's rent. And in San Francisco, for example, it's tied to the consumer price index. It's tied to inflation, and landlords cannot increase rent by more than a certain fraction of the CPI.
So sometimes it's just a formula that your rents are governed by. Sometimes the city sets it in a more top-down way.
That's right.
And you meant Cambridge, Massachusetts.
That's
near
right.
Boston. So how common is rent control nationwide? In California, there are some cities that have it, some big cities. What about in the rest of the country? You mentioned Cambridge.
So it's somewhat of a dying breed. It was more prevalent historically. It was certainly everyone's darling in the rapid price increases that we saw around World War II and the ending there. It's very prevalent in New York, New Jersey, D.C., Maryland, and California towns. But outside of those kind of five areas, there's not a lot of rent control left in the United States.
Why has that happened? What's with the change?
Well, there are lots of reasons. One is that from the perspective of economists, it could exacerbate the very problem it's designed to protect. The idea is that we have some kind of housing shortage that's leading to high rents. We want to fix that, so let's cap the rents, and that could make it so there are more people competing for fewer apartments. It could exacerbate the problem to begin with. So it's one thing that we've kind of moved away from. That said, obviously, popular back in Richmond again, Albany, New York recently voted to bring it back in their town. So affordability is certainly an ongoing concern in many parts of the country.
I know you've done some research on rent control recently, including one study that just came out, and I do want to talk about that a little bit going forward. But Dean Preston, let me come to you. Why rent control? Your organization was among those that supported Richmond's new law. What is your one biggest argument, the strongest case to be made in favor of rent control?
Well, the strongest case to be made for rent control is that it controls the rent, keeps homes affordable, and prevents displacement of tenants. What a lot of people don't understand is that without rent control in California, a landlord can double your rent with a 60-day notice. And so often people get into the weeds of the details of rent control. But if you ask people quite simply, do you believe that a landlord should be able to double a tenant's rent? Should that be legal? You get a resounding no. And I would argue if you answer no to that question, you believe in rent control. And the question is just how we're going to implement it, what kind of standards we're going to use. But rent control is a proven success at preventing displacement. It's a proven success at maintaining some level of affordability in booming real estate markets. And I would just take issue with one thing that Professor Palmer just said around why there was a reduction or a move away from rent control. I think it has much more to do with the power of the real estate lobby and a concerted effort and a lot of money spent in state capitals across the country and especially in Sacramento to try to weaken or eliminate rent control ordinance. I think that's much more the case than any economic studies.
I do want to get more into the politics of that as well. But first, Tom Bannon, I want to ask you the same question from the opposite angle. Why not rent control? What is the one biggest risk factor, the biggest detriment that should make residents think twice about supporting this?
Well, you know, probably the biggest thing is that once you cap rent, the incentive for the property owner to maintain the property clearly begins to go away. Maintenance of property, incredibly important. And additionally, it sends a message to the rest of those that wish to invest in housing that you should probably stay clear.
So it just makes a market look less desirable.
Correct. Absolutely.
Now, very few people are landlords. Far more, I would suspect, are tenants or homeowners. Talk to me about your members, the people who are on the business end of this transaction, as it were, and what they say they encounter under rent control laws. Is it really that bad a thing for them, or are most of them kind of doing okay?
Well, I mean the issue really is, you know, once rent control goes into a community, what generally happens is that those property owners who find themselves under rent control, you know, clearly the incentive goes away to maintain that property to some degree. Additionally, what happens is, and, you know, Dean's efforts, you know, we are aligned at the issue of providing working class housing, very, very important. But all you have to do is look into San Francisco, Santa Monica, and Berkeley, and ultimately you have some of the highest rents in the country in those areas, and those communities have rent control.
Do you think those rents would be as high if San Francisco, Santa Monica, and Berkeley weren't places that a lot of people wanted to be? I mean, might they not just be high anyway?
Well, I think what happens is that it is a supply and demand issue. It's kind of basic economics 101. And so the moment that you begin to take the incentive away for there to be investment in housing, what then happens is individuals that make the decision to invest begin to back out. Or the worst case scenario is you then develop a situation where people begin to game the system. And the end result is that you have higher rents going because you just don't have housing on the market. In San Francisco, and the projection is there's somewhere between 10,000 and 20,000 units that are held off the market because people do not want to insert themselves into the rent control bureaucracy.
So they would rather just hold on to the property than deal with what you're describing as this kind of rigmarole of the economics of being a landlord.
Or get out of the business.
Or get out of the business, right.
Correct. Correct.
We're discussing rent control in California with Christopher Palmer of UC Berkeley, Dean Preston of Tenants Together, and Tom Bannon of the California Apartment Association. Dean, I do want to give you a chance to respond to Tom, but first, I want to make sure we give our listeners a chance to chime in. I want to hear what you think of rent control. If you are a tenant listening to this right now, or maybe if you're looking for a place to live, what impact has it had on you? Maybe you're a landlord or a property owner. How has rent control affected your business? And no matter who you are, what should we do to spare renters from being priced out? Should it be rent control, or maybe should it be something else? So join the conversation. Give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. You can also find us on Facebook or tweet us. We are at KQED Forum. Dean Preston, Tom told us some of the stories that he's hearing from landlords. Give us an example of some of the stories you hear from the tenants you deal with who are struggling with rising rents. We hear them all the time in the Bay Area these days, but if you could generalize, how do these stories typically go in your experience?
Well, we run a hotline at Tenants Together. We have tenants calling us from all over the state, and especially recently a lot of calls in the last year from Bay Area tenants. And we are seeing shocking rent increases. We're not talking about whether the rent should go up 2% or 5% in a particular year. We are seeing landlords that are literally doubling the rent. Double-digit rent increases are common, triple-digit rent increases, and these are on working people. So they, you know, think about, for your listeners and their friends, family, how many people can get a notice from their landlord that their rent, which today might be $1,000 or $2,000, is going to double or go up by 50% and actually be able to pay that. So these are rent increases that aren't just taking more money from tenants. These are rent increases that are basically eviction notices, and it's happening across the Bay Area. And I think one of the reasons you see the success in Richmond and the rise in calls for rent control is as the rents are surging, the industry arguments and talking points against rent control really haven't been updated to reflect the reality of rent control. So when I hear, for example, Mr. Bannon say that there's a problem with incentives to purchase rental property, I mean, people are lining up to purchase rental property, and the prices are going through the roof of rent-controlled housing in cities like San Francisco. We do not need additional incentives or to take away controls to make people buy rental housing. Landlords are doing fabulously under rent control. They're not doing as fabulously as they would be doing if there were no controls on the rent, but the trade-off is we would not have a working class living in a city like San Francisco were it not for rent control.
Tom, what do you make of that?
Well, I mean, from Dean's perspective, the issue is working class families, and, you know, we totally agree that we've got to provide housing for everybody. But the moment you begin to control the market versus looking at why is the market prices moving, and market prices move for one very simple reason. It's about supply and demand. And so realistically, you know, a short-term fix. I mean, rent control. You know, you sort of hear about putting Band-Aid on a major wound. I sort of look at rent control as trying to put a Q-tip into a leak in Hoover Dam. You got to first figure out, you know, why is the dam so filled? I mean, from the state of California's perspective, from the city of San Francisco, the issue really is about, you know, how do you create additional supply, number one, and number two, how do we as a society assure that working class families, individuals, that they have the resources to, in fact, find housing. But the moment you restrict, you will, in fact, find yourself creating this bureaucracy of the haves, the have-nots. You have all of a sudden tenants and landlords battle each other, where the real goal here is how do you fix this problem? And it's about supply, and it's about figuring out the resources to ensure that those working class families can find housing.
I do want to get more into the supply and demand argument in a minute, especially sure, with Professor Palmer. But first, let's bring in someone who has had a hand in getting Richmond's rent control ordinance passed. Joining us now on the phone is Mike Parker of the Richmond Progressive Alliance. Mike, good morning.
Good morning.
How would you characterize the debate over rent control in Richmond? Was it an uphill battle to gain support, or were people pretty much in favor of it throughout?
No, it's been a 10-year battle to get the city council to even consider it. 10 years ago, when it was first introduced, there was only one council person who was willing to support it. It took a lot of work to build a progressive council which would be willing to consider this seriously, and we're very proud of that fact. There's one issue that has been driving people that nobody has mentioned. In Richmond, we're very concerned about maintaining neighborhood stability. Neighborhood stability is very important for maintaining safety. That's why we're very much behind community policing. We support neighborhood councils. And the thing about zooming rents is that they drive people out of their housing. New people come in, and then the rents go up, and then they're driven out. And in order to maintain, renters are about half our population in Richmond. If we want to maintain stable communities, we have to offer some kind of stability to the renters who live in those neighborhoods.
What about the business community's concerns about actually doing harm to Richmond's housing market? How much, if at all, are you concerned about that?
I'm not very concerned about that. Under state law, the rent control does not apply to any new housing that is built. So there's nothing preventing investors who see a booming housing market here from coming in and building more housing in Richmond. The rent control ordinance that was passed makes allowances for landlords who might be having difficulties and guarantees them a fair return. So if they're having difficulties, they have to spend more money on a roof or something, some capital improvement, all they have to do is to demonstrate that, and they are entitled to get a rent increase. We're basically saying that a landlord cannot increase, under normal circumstances, a landlord can't increase rent faster than the cost of living is going up.
They always say the devil is in the details. What details of Richmond's new rent control law are you most concerned about the city getting right?
Well, I am very concerned about them getting right an easy path for landlords who are in difficulty to take care of this. I'm very concerned that we make sure that tenants completely understand their rights and what the limitations are of this ordinance. This ordinance, for example, doesn't prevent landlords from raising rates on places once an apartment is empty. So people should understand that they can't just simply expect to find the rent level staying where they are if they're moving around. We want to encourage stability, and if people understand both their rights and their obligations, we think it'll work out well.
Gotcha. Well, I appreciate you making time for us. That's Mike Parker of the Richmond Progressive Alliance. Mike, thanks for talking to us.
Okay, thank you.
Before we get moving on the phones, and please do feel free to send in your calls and emails. The phone lines are full at the moment, so email might be easier, forum@kqed.org. Tom, I just wanted to go back to you and give you a chance to respond to one of the arguments that Dean had made in terms of a landlord being able to double your rent. That feels like a very real threat, and not just even an idle threat if you are a renter. I mean, that can be the kind of factor that I know a lot of people I know has kept them where they are because they know I dare not move because I'm going to end up paying more and the person coming after me is going to end up paying more. What do you make of that?
Yeah, well, you know what? I'm not sure that people are doubling rent. There is some rent growth that is taking place, but doubling rents, I think, is, you know, that is clearly not the norm.
I live in San Francisco, and the rents have doubled all around me in the 5 years that I've lived here. So it may not be the norm, but it's happening.
But I don't think you – but the norm is not going to be somebody who is in a unit and that their rent doubles at lease renewal. That is not the norm. If in fact, rents are going up, it's generally a result of an existing resident moving out and then the owner basically moving that rent to the market rent. But the notion that somebody's rent is being doubled, I don't buy it, do I? I mean, are there rent increases? Absolutely there are. But the other thing to keep in mind is that people that have invested in the industry have had good times and they've had bad times. and they basically make the decision to make an investment, whether it's the mom and pop or whether it is those folks who are, you know, pension, you know, that, you know, some of our public employee, you know, pension accounts invest in real estate and in rental housing. And it's up and down, but everybody's taking a risk by, in fact, investing in rental housing.
You're talking about these REITs, real estate investment trusts.
No. I mean, it's much more than that. I mean, you know, even CalPERS and STIRS, basically to assure that public employees' pension accounts have adequate funding, they not only invest in, you know, some of the real estate investment trusts, but in private equity markets, that everybody looks at it as real estate being important. Now, look, nobody likes to see rent increases, but you got to also keep in mind that as capital flows to the apartment industry, you actually find yourself assuring that the rental housing stock stays in great position. A lot of those units basically find themselves being updated. You get new carpeting, you get tile.
Right.
I mean, you get painting, and that then results in jobs for a variety of different people. So it is not an easy explanation, and it's a cycle of, you know, kind of economics that, you know, that our economists could probably explain better than I can.
We got a few more minutes left before the bottom of the hour, and we have to take a break, but I want to get to maybe one or two calls before we take our first break. 866-733-6786. Let's begin with Abby in San Francisco. Abby, good morning.
Good morning. Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind, Abby?
Well, I own a building in San Francisco. It's a 6-unit building, and I am 100% pro rent control. And I actually really disagree with some of the characterization of landlords that, you know, as people who, you know, just want to kind of maximize their profit and don't care really about maintenance unless it's, you know, going to result in higher rents and things like that. I really feel like there are a number of landlords who, you know, when you buy a building, you're aware of all of the costs. You know how much rent you're going to be getting. You know about how you can calculate about how much maintenance is going to cost. And I think people should be taking that into account. And, you know, turnover is natural in a building. And, you know, even when rents are high other places, people move on for other reasons. And you can eventually increase your rents when people move out and new people move in. But I just think rent control really does help maintain the community, you know, the character of our wonderful city, and you know, and keeps things human, and people, you know, and the kind of tenants that actually we like to see.
Gotcha.
In our building.
Gotcha. Hey, Abby, I appreciate you sharing your thoughts. Thanks for calling in. Let me get to one more comment from a listener who wrote us online. Sometimes people simply can't afford to live where they want. If you don't make enough money to live in a particular city, you must move to a city you can afford. Why does the government need to get involved? I want to live in Malibu. Should I ask my congressman to subsidize my rent? We'll keep the phone calls and the emails coming, but it's time for a break now. When we can come back, we'll continue our conversation on rent control in California with Christopher Palmer of UC Berkeley, Dean Preston of Tenants Together, and Tom Bannon of the California Apartment Association. Feel free to keep calling 866-733-6786. Email us, forum@kqed.org. Find us on Facebook or tweet us. We are at KQED Forum. I'm Joshua Johnson. Glad to be with you. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Mina Kim. We're continuing our conversation on rent control in California with Christopher Palmer of UC Berkeley, Dean Preston of Tenants Together, and Tom Bannon of the California Apartment Association. The only thing missing is you, so call us, 866-733-6786. Email us, the address is forum@kqed.org, and post your comments online, go to kqed.org/forum. Let me get to a few online comments now. Wooly tweeted us, on KQED Forum, the host mentions every city in California with rent control except Oakland. My apologies. Oakland does indeed have rent control. Nothing against Oakland. Diane wrote us via email, why isn't rent control need-based and subsidized by the public at large? If this is a public policy, the public should be underwriting it. Christopher Palmer, what do you make of that? A need-based rent control?
Yeah, so economists call this a program being means tested, and you would imagine that there are a lot of affordable housing programs that work this way. If you want to go to your local – if you want to get a Section 8 voucher, or if you want to go to your local housing authority and qualify for a housing unit, they're going to say, show us your tax return so we can show that you're below the poverty line or whatever our threshold is for receiving that. Rent control is not means tested. That's one knock against it. On the other hand, that makes it a little bit light bureaucratically. It doesn't have quite the same burden. So when you – sign up for a rent control apartment, all you have to do is qualify for that unit. And so there are anecdotes of very well-to-do people that are living in rent control apartments, and that's the sense in which it's blunt. On the flip side of that is just that the state doesn't have to chase around qualifying people, and so it's less complicated from one perspective.
As I understand it, most economists today, anyway, really do not believe rent control is a good idea. Why is that?
Yeah, so we, in fact, use it in
And I'm not asking this to get at your views.
Sure,
I'm just asking
sure.
you to extrapolate in general
sure,
what economists
gonna,
are saying.
I'm going to keep my lab coat on here.
And
as a profession, we don't receive particularly high marks on consensus. Harry Truman famously said, I just want a one-handed economist, one that doesn't keep saying on the one hand and on the other hand. But for economists that look at the simplest form of rent control, it just seems like a classic price ceiling. It is a supply and demand issue. Something like 95% of economists agree that rent control reduces the quantity and the quality of the available affordable housing. And the reason for that is just that it creates a situation where you have even more people looking for these great deals where you're going to sign up for reasonable rent increases and fewer people that are interested in renting them. So that's kind of the most simplistic view of it, that it exacerbates this shortage. There are a lot of other side effects that come with any price ceiling. But that said, there's a flip side to all of these things. So we have now modern rent control policies that try to tinker with a lot of these. You keep mentioning the devil's in the details. So-called second wave rent control policies that have things like an exemption for new construction. So I shouldn't be gun shy about building a nice new apartment building because I have California law that says anything built after a certain time is going to be exempt from rent control. So if I trust that, then I shouldn't be worried about building new affordable housing. And then another thing that is an important characteristic that's mentioned by a couple people so far is vacancy decontrol. So once your tenant leaves, they can't pass it on to their cousin. They can't pass it on to their son. If they leave, then you can reset your apartment to market rate. And that's Richmond's plan as well, is to have this vacancy decontrol.
Dean Preston, I wanted to get back to you in terms of one of the arguments that that Tom Bannon made earlier in terms of rent control leading to basically higher rents and shabbier buildings, that there's less incentive for landlords to maintain their buildings and that it ultimately has that inflationary power on rents. What do you make of that?
I disagree. I think some of the economic theories and writing on this in the past, as I think Professor Palmer is alluding to, that don't really fit with our actually with what's developed in terms of the law in California and how rent control actually operates. A lot of the so-called anti-rent control or writings that don't support it are based on a system that's not our system in terms of vacancy decontrol, new construction being exempt. But I also think it's important that as more and more cities now are calling for rent control and Richmond has passed it, that we take a look at the actual experience of the cities that have it, the predictions that properties won't be well maintained, for example, is absolutely not the case. What Mr. Bannon can certainly confirm, there's California law that requires property owners that are landlords to maintain their properties in a certain way. And if you want properties maintained a certain way, you enforce those laws. So the cities like San Francisco that actively and proactively enforce the habitability laws have better maintained properties. You can look across the Central Valley. You can look in the Inland Empire. You can look in countless communities in California that do not have rent control and have active slumlords. It's not rent control that's causing people not to invest. It's slumlords who don't respect habitability laws.
Tom Bannon, what do you make of that?
Well, I mean, first of all, maintaining property, our members maintain their property. The vast majority of the industry maintains its property because it makes economic sense. There's a difference between maintaining property and improving property and keeping the property current with everything from electrical to plumbing to appliances, you name it, and it just keeps going on. But I do think, Joshua, one of the points that was made earlier about means testing. You know, what's kind of funny is that when you look at San Francisco, the San Francisco Rent Board used to keep track of those renters that occupied the rent-controlled units. And the last time that they did the study, and I want to say it was maybe 8 years ago, what they found was that 30% of the tenants that were in occupied rental units were making in excess of $100,000. Now, the rent board no longer does the study. I'm not going to guess why they stopped doing it. I would suspect that because the ultimate goal, obviously, was to provide housing for low and moderate income housing or individuals. But if you got 30% of the rent control stock in San Francisco was occupied by residents making in excess of $100,000, the means testing issue is something that, you know, we all ought to look at and all would be concerned about.
Well, but couldn't that mean that the other 70% are making less than $100,000 and really do need that rent control?
Well, if in fact that's the case, then we ought to look at that situation and we ought to figure out a general public policy issue in terms of how you truly solve that problem. I don't want to talk specifically about Richmond, but I tell you, I was a little bit taken back because I went on the KQED site and I looked and I saw that right under the more info was Richmond's plan to bring decaying houses back from the dead. And I read the wonderful story that KQED had. And here you're talking about 1,000-plus homes in the city of Richmond that they call zombie homes. You ask yourself the question, these homes that are vacant and gone, and the story goes on to talk about the owners have left those homes, and the heirs to those homes can't even be found. So you pose the question to yourself, if you've got 1,000 people have left these homes vacant and they're not being utilized, what else is going on in Richmond, and why would you think that if you've already got 1,000 homes that have been vacated and you put rent control on investors, property owners, what's the incentive to stay?
Yeah, gotcha. Let's continue on the phones. We had a bunch of people waiting very patiently, including Alyssa in Pacifica. Alyssa, good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I've been thinking about the issue of stability from the standpoint of those of us who work in occupations that just simply don't get pay raises. So I teach high school, and one of our school board, our school board president for our district, this is an elected official, her rent was about to go up by $1,000 a month. She couldn't stay there. She almost had to move out of the borders of the district that she'd been elected to serve because there was nowhere that was going to rent to her for something that was anything like affordable. For our teachers, we're constantly losing people because we got a huge pay increase this year of 3%. But some of our teachers had rent increases of 10% and 15% that far exceeded what they were going to make as an increase in the paltry salary that we get. So if you want to talk about stability, this isn't just, you know, keeping kind of like everyday corporations, with employees. This is also about your nurses and your teachers and your firefighters and those people who really, you know, form the pillars of your society. And when those people can't afford to stay in the neighborhoods that they represent and that they serve,
right,
you have the deconstruction of your community and your society.
I hear that. Alyssa, thank you for calling. And actually, since you brought that up, my colleague KQED Stephanie Martin Taylor did a story a while back. It's probably still on our website about certain communities that are considering incentives for teachers to move in. So you move in and you get a bonus that is specifically for housing. That idea hasn't quite taken root yet, although Christopher Palmer, I don't know if you've heard of other places that do that kind of thing because they know that rents are going up. Is that common?
Maybe I'm thinking of the same story, but it was somewhere in the South Bay in Silicon Valley where they were subsidizing their teachers relocating there. But North Carolina, for example, has a first-time homebuyer tax credit policy that they've always had, and other states do as well, other jurisdictions, that's specifically targeted at these professions that we seem to want as part of our community fabric, teachers, firefighters, nurses, that kind of a thing.
Let's continue. Oh, go ahead, Dean.
Well, I just wanted to say that there are a number of solutions that are costly and that we may support, things that provide incentives and help stabilize folks. But I wanted to emphasize that in terms of cost effectiveness, nothing compares to rent control. I mean, if a city council passes rent control, sets up a pretty minimal rent board system, that can bring rent control and stability to tens of thousands of units. So in a city like San Francisco, 170,000 units are under rent control. It's very cost effective, and it's paid for by a very small annual fee by landlords.
Let's continue on the phones now with Suzette in San Francisco. Suzette, good morning.
Good morning. I am both a renter under rent control and a landlord. And one of the ideas that I've been tossing around to help landlords with maintenance costs is that perhaps there could be something, I don't know, written into a lease maybe, that the tenants share in the cost of maybe basic maintenance or even improvements. Because I do sympathize with landlords who have maybe a large building full of very low rent tenants, and then it's very expensive to even maintain that building sometimes. So that's just my suggestion.
That's an interesting idea, Suzette. Thanks very much. Dean, did you want to react to that?
Sure. Every rent control system in every city of the 13 cities that have rent control in California allow a capital improvement pass-throughs, certain operating and maintenance pass-throughs. There is always a method under a rent control law that when a landlord has large unanticipated capital expenses that they can seek permission to pass those through to tenants.
Let's continue on the phones now with Ben in New York. Ben, good morning.
Hi, good afternoon from New York.
Yes, good afternoon. What part of the city are you in?
I'm in Washington Heights. It's Washington Heights, yeah.
Excellent. Well, thanks for calling in from Washington Heights. What's on your mind, Ben?
Me and my wife moved into a rent-controlled apartment. But before we were on the search, we were looking around for apartments. And there are two kinds of apartments. There's those that are under rent control and those that aren't. And, some of the newer ones have a new kitchen. But they start at $2,100, $1,900 was like negotiating and then brokers, whatever, all the craziness. But then rent-controlled houses, apartments, it doesn't have a new toilet. Okay, but they're $1,300, and our floor is like a little, so we moved into an apartment with a little crooked floor, and like, I look at my wife, and at the end of the day, we're sitting in our apartment on our couch, and it's a little bit of a crooked floor, and I look at her, and I say, for $700 a month, you want a straight floor? And she's like, it's okay.
You can deal with the crooked floor.
Yeah. And, a lot of these buildings in my neighborhood, they're being, vamped up. And then the apartments are crazy. I mean, they're beautiful. But that's not I'm a university student. We're in a university town. I mean, Yeshiva University is right around us. What's it called? Fordham's also right near us. We don't need, people moving from the Upper West Side here. Or at least we need affordable housing for people students who otherwise cannot afford it.
So basically what you needed was a clean, safe place for you to live and do what you needed to do. You didn't need anything fancy schmancy.
Yeah, exactly. And when we talk about, I think when we're talking about, redoing the house upkeep, it's not upkeep or, improvements. These are like they're making, granite countertops and brick walls. I mean, it's really a little too much for me. And I don't think that, we're talking about little improvements. I think we're talking about people who are trying to really make these, sprawling apartments.
Gotcha. Ben, I really appreciate you calling in. Thanks for talking to us. Let me continue with a few comments from online. One of our listeners wrote us via email, as a property owner in Berkeley for more than 10 years, the rent control is totally unfair and has been judged so by an independent Alameda County grand jury. I have a number of tenants who have been in my property for 8-plus years, some of whom have openly told me they will never move. Yearly, the rent board provides me with the ability for minimal rent increases, yet over the same period, my expenses have increased by a much higher percentage. All the talk of cost of living increases is rubbish. Rent increases are a fraction of the cost of living increase. Tom, does that echo what some of your members have encountered?
Absolutely. The issue is about, that if there's a problem, then the problem needs to be addressed from the individual community. You can't put it on the property owner, and the bureaucracy it doesn't work.
Go ahead, Dean.
I just think that there's a reality check needed. The idea that Tom is not seeing these kind of high rent increases that far outpace actual costs increases to the landlord. You know, the California Apartment Association itself sent a mailing in the San Mateo and Santa Clara area with a big wanted poster type face to its own members saying, don't let this be you. And the whole mailing was about don't raise rents over 10%. They know that their members are raising rents far in excess of the actual cost increases they're facing. They know that it's a public relations disaster and that because of the excessive rent increases, more and more cities will be adopting rent control.
Before we go on, I just wanted to respond quickly to what the listener wrote about the Alameda County grand jury. I looked it up real quickly, and according to our KQED News partner Berkeley side, that is true. There was a highly critical report that found the Berkeley Rent Stabilization Board is, quote, a self-sustaining bureaucracy that operates without effective oversight and accountability. The rent board responded to that by stating in part that the report relies on inaccuracies, half-truths, and innuendo to give a veneer of plausibility to its claims. And that was back in 2012. Let's continue with some of your comments. Jen wrote us on Facebook, we've lived in a place for 4 years, and our landlord surprised us with a 55% rent increase 2 months before our lease ended. That was basically an eviction notice for us. We've been good tenants, and we've had a good relationship with our landlord, but this blew us out of the water. We were fortunate enough to be in a position where we could buy, since the new rent would have been on par with a mortgage. But I feel terrible for lower-income residents who would not have as many options as we do. Back to the phones now with Edith in Richmond. Edith, good morning.
Hi there. Thank you for covering this topic. I'm kind of ground zero for the rent control issue in Richmond. My mom died unexpectedly in February. She had just bought a house in October. And my brother and I were left with a house with a mortgage. And we've been working for months to upgrade the house so that we could put it on the market, because not on the rental market, because we didn't really want to sell it. It was just purchased. And I wasn't going to call, but I find it kind of curious that the renters who are calling in support of rent control really have in their mind that a lot of the landlords are all big corporations making millions. Most of us are not. Most of us are like my brother and me, that are left with a situation where we have to put a house on the rental market or let it go. And the comment that got to me was this: I'm only getting a paltry 3% raise. When you limit the amount that we can raise our rents to 2%, 3%, and 4% a year, you're saying to me that I can only get a 4% raise. That the same raise that an individual will say is a paltry raise for their own income from a company. This is my retirement.
Right.
This is my inheritance. This is something I've waited my whole life for.
Hey, Edith, I get your point, and I really appreciate you calling. First of all, condolences on the passing of your mother. Secondly, I can kind of get the impression that this makes you feel like you're being unfairly targeted. So thank you for calling in, and I want to put that point to Dean. I mean, Edith brings up a very valid point, which is that many landlords are not these big corporations. I know mine isn't. Mine is just a family company that happens to be wonderful people who happen to own the building I live in. How do we have this conversation humanely and remember that these are people on both sides of this fence?
Sure. Well, increasingly, actually, there's a consolidation of rental housing in large investment companies, and Wall Street has entered the rental market in a big way. So there is a trend, but at the same time, we certainly acknowledge that there are a lot of smaller landlords out there. Smaller landlords that are not looking to gouge their tenants or evict them for no reason are largely unaffected by rent control laws. You had one of the callers earlier who was was a landlord in San Francisco who was supportive of rent control. And there are a lot of landlords who understand, who have no intention of raising rents at extreme levels. For the particular caller just now, I would need to know more about the place. If it's a single-family home that was inherited, it's exempt categorically from rent control. So that would have no impact. And I would also just note that the costs for the owner – it's not like they're runaway costs. California has Prop 13. The owner's single biggest cost, which is taxes,
property taxes,
right? Property taxes. They effectively have rent control on that for as long as they own that property. That the increases are going to be under 2%, basically. And so it seems fundamentally unfair to allow landlords to benefit from their costs being controlled by Prop 13 and then be able to impose unlimited rent increases on their tenants.
Let's continue with a few more online comments. One listener writes, if as a society we want to help people with lesser incomes rent, we should be prepared to pay local taxes to build new housing and to pay landlords subsidies rather than penalize them. It is an odd kind of taking of property to impose controls on rent. Michael wrote us via Facebook, how is rent control slowing the market, especially in the Bay Area? My rent in Pacifica is about to go up $300 this year, and they only offer six-month leases. How is that okay? It's called greed. And another listener writes, your guest keeps talking about how rent is about supply and demand, but he's entirely leaving out one side of that equation in his solution. The problem is that if you eliminate rent control, it will increase supply, but that supply increase will barely make a dent in rental prices because the demand is so phenomenally high. Tom Bannon, what do you make of that last comment?
Well, I think what I would say is two things. First of all, it is about supply and demand. You don't have rent control discussions in Houston or Dallas or in Phoenix, and there's a reason for that, because there's adequate demand. But second of all, the other thing to keep in mind is that this is all driven by jobs. And so,
I'm sorry. I want to make sure I heard you correctly. Supply. Do you mean you don't hear those debates in Dallas and Houston and Phoenix because there's adequate supply or adequate demand? You said demand.
I'm sorry. There's adequate supply.
Okay. Just making sure.
Go ahead. Adequate supply. And I mean, keep in mind that this is being driven by jobs. And basically what you have happening is that you have jobs coming into California, particularly in Northern California. You have local communities that are doing everything in their power to bring jobs in. The problem is that nobody's making an ongoing effort to bring in the housing to match that demand. I mean, the other thing to keep in mind is it's not as though there aren't a number of people who are looking for rental units. If somebody moves out, and look, it's unfortunate if they cannot afford the rent. That is a problem, no question about it. But it's not like somebody's not moving into that unit. And so people don't want to hear this. You know, there's a story in the Wall Street Journal about what's going on in Colorado. And you've got this explosion of people going into Boulder, Colorado, and Denver. And you talk to some of the folks that are in Denver, and they're saying, gosh, there's a lot of apartment construction. I'm not sure I like this because it's going to block my view of the mountains. We have to make a decision. Are we going to accommodate the job growth? And if we are, then we have to provide the housing adequate to do that. And no question that those individuals who have a challenge in finding housing, we've got to figure out a way to do that. But you don't give rental units to people that are making in excess of $100,000.
We've got a few more minutes left in the hour. Let me get to a few more calls and comments. Ron in Kensington. Ron, good morning.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
I'm generally not keen on rent control. I prefer to see, you know, liberalizing the market for building units. But one point about any place you've had rent control, and that will happen in Richmond, is it tends to drive people towards condo conversion. So the number of rental units declines, and the units that were there as rental units become condo-type units. And this happens everywhere. I mean, it's amazing some of the properties in Berkeley that converted from rental to owner. And I mean, they were really... these are crappy places, but it was the smartest thing for the owners to do.
Hey, Ron, I hate to cut you short, but we're running out of time in the hour. Thank you for sharing that thought with us. Christopher Palmer, is that something that we've seen happen where rent control kind of leads to these property conversions?
So, yeah, I think that does happen in a lot of places. And in tandem with a rent control law, to make that effective, you have to put in some kind of condo conversion law that has teeth. And that those are often very contested.
Let's continue on the phones with Michael in San Jose. Michael, good morning.
Good morning. San Jose has rent control at 22% every 2 years, or 8% every year. And I've lived in the same apartment for 15 years, and it doubled. And I'm wondering, how do they figure that the middle-class people, people that are making $75,000 and below, going to be able to live in the area?
I hear that. That's a good point, Michael. Dean Press?
Well, and San Jose does have rent control, but it has one of the weaker rent control laws in the state that, as the caller knows, allows a very substantial rent increases higher than other rent control laws. And just, you know, for some context about affordability, you know, our minimum wage in California is $9 an hour, right? The National Low-Income Housing Coalition releases an annual survey and a study on what they call the housing wage. What would you have to earn to pay 30% of your rent, which is the recommended amount, to rent? And in California, it's $26.65 with a $9 per hour with a $9 minimum wage. In the Bay Area, it's even worse. In San Francisco, San Mateo, Marin, Santa Clara, it's up approaching $40 an hour. You'd need to work 4 full-time minimum wage jobs to afford the median rent. We need to do something urgently. And I agree with a lot of the comments about building affordable housing. We should do that. But it's not either or. We need rent control in high-rent communities.
That's Dean Preston of Tenants Together. Dean, thanks for being with us for the hour.
Thanks for having me.
Tom Bannon, CEO of the California Apartment Association. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
And Assistant Professor Christopher Palmer of UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business. Christopher, thanks for talking to us.
My pleasure.
Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Laubert, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement editor is Amanda Stupine. We get online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our interns are LaToya Tools and Jeremy Siegel. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you for listening. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.